This presentation is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Financial Services. UBS Financial Services does not verify and does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of the information presented. American Century and UBS Financial Services are not affiliated. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of our podcast series, Hot Topics for Plan Sponsors. I'm Bruce Lanzer, a senior retirement plan consultant with UBS in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And in this session, I'll be speaking with Glenn Dial about trends in plan guaranteed income. Glenn is a retirement strategist, I should say senior retirement strategist with American Century. Now, in-plan lifetime income is something that has been percolating, you might say, for many years. Most recently, the SECURE Act encouraged adoption of income solutions by providing fiduciaries to offer a solution with safe harbor protections. And in kind, the retirement industry has responded with a variety of options and different investment structures. So, Glenn, first of all, let me thank you for sharing your experience and expertise with us today.
Thank you, Bruce, and thanks for having me on the show.
I'm looking forward to what the research shows and what you have to share with us. So let's dive right in. What are you seeing in the industry, Glenn?
Yeah, and we absolutely want to start with the research. And what we've done is we've partnered with Greenwald and Associates, and we've done this survey every year for the last 10 years. And we surveyed about 1,500 plan participants and about 500 employers, okay, plan sponsors, to get these results that we're going to talk about now. And we asked a lot of questions this past year about guaranteed income inside of 401k plans. Probably not surprisingly, nearly all employers agreed that it's important to provide features that allow their employees to turn their balance into a reliable income stream. So that shouldn't really, again, come as a surprise. I know my parents had what we call a traditional pension plan where they had guaranteed income. 401k plans, for the most part, right, have been missing that feature. So we're seeing this pent-up demand, if you will, for these guaranteed type income features inside 401k plans to make them look more like pension plans. When we asked employers, well, how do you want to incorporate these features? I mean, how do you just want to add them as a separate standalone option in your 401k plan? Do you want to incorporate it to an existing investment? I thought this was interesting. About 63%, so two out of three, said they'd rather incorporate it into an existing investment option, such as a target date fund. And I would extend it out to managed accounts also. So I think the reason for that is it's less complicated, less confusing for their employees, right? If they don't have to roll out a whole new product, have to explain it. So if they incorporate it into something that their employees already know and understand and add that guaranteed income component, that seems to be the path of least resistance. The other big part of this, which I think is really important, is the question of default. And in some ways, I feel like we're reliving the target date days all over again. When target date funds first came out, we had this big industry discussion. Should employees be defaulted in them or not, right? And I think what we learned, especially from our days back in the 90s, if we build it, they will not come. So if we think this is something that's good for employees and that they need these kinds of types of protections that these products provide, then in reality, we need to look at default, meaning defaulting the employees into it. So when we asked employers, how do you feel about that? It was split almost down the middle, but about slightly less than half said that they'd prefer guaranteed income be the default, which is good, right? It's a good start. We're just now having this discussion, and I don't recall the numbers being that high when target date funds came out. This is a good sign.
Definitely. And in my own experience, you know, advising plans, several we've had some form of guaranteed income option in for probably 10 years or so. And we have set them up as the default. And the participants like that. They would much rather be defaulted there than, you know, have to make the selection. And, you know, when I've had discussions with, you know, the participants, you know, particularly after market downturns like we had, you know, with COVID in March of 2020, they're really happy that they were defaulted there and to know they had that protection. So I'm all in favor of the defaulting side.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that story up. I always jokingly talk about my first job out of school, and I joke about my first enrollment meeting in the defined benefit plan, traditional pension plan, and how I remember every word about it. And the reason I remember every word is we didn't have one, right? Everything was done for me.
Right.
I didn't have to learn anything. I didn't have to make any decisions. It was just done.
It was easy.
I'm going to get a pension.
Yep.
That was it.
Yep.
So obviously default's a big deal. And then we asked some follow-up questions in the survey. So we asked employees, you know, hey, how important it is to protect the entire value of your workplace savings account, so your 401k account, in the event of a stock market crash. And no surprise, 3/4% said sure, I want my account value protected in a stock market crash. So what we're finding out is employees want their cake, they want to eat it too. In other words, they want the growth of the stock market, but they want downside protection. And then we said, well, when do you want this downside protection to start? What age? Should it start at age 50 or 55, 60? What should it be? And a whopping 82% of all the employees we surveyed, 82% said they want that protection to start before age 65. A total of 30% said they want that protection to start as early as age 50. So I know some people call it the retirement red zone. We call it the transition risk zone, whatever you want to call it. We know that as we get closer to retirement, we become more risk adverse and we want some kind of protection in place because our account values are a lot bigger. We got a lot more to lose, right? And we don't necessarily have the time to make up for those losses, right? Because we don't know when we might think we're going to retire at 65, but if I get laid off earlier, then I might be retiring at 60 and not even know it.
Correct.
The other big question that we got, and I think this might be one of the most important questions, is when we ask them when we ask participants or employees, how important is it to maintain 100% control and flexibility of their retirement account after they retire? So, and guess what? Over 3/4 of participants said that it's at least very important. Okay. So they don't want, and I think this is something, if I had to say a downside of a traditional pension plan, the downside was you didn't have a lot of control, right? You retired, you got a monthly check, and you couldn't change your mind and say, you know what? I've got some unexpected medical expenses, or maybe I unfortunately have found out I have a terminal illness. I don't need guaranteed payments the rest of my life. I need the money, right? Or maybe I want to leave that money to my heirs. And that's what the good news is, a lot of the products that are being rolled out in these 401k plans will leave the participant in control so they can get that guaranteed income, yet they can change their mind at any time, take their money, leave it to heirs, all that fun stuff. So that I'd argue this is the, you know, once these are kind of picked up by the mainstream, this is going to be potentially better than a traditional pension plan or defined benefit plan.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And when we asked them, well, you know, saying you want control is one thing, but when we said, all right, let's put some dollars to it, you know, how much are you willing to give up to maintain that control? So for example, we asked, would you prefer getting 5% of your account balance in terms of income, right? Do you want 5% income and have complete control and have more control, or would you give up some control and we'll give you more money? We'll give you 6%. So would you go ahead and trade some of that control if that guarantee will go up? And believe it or not, twice as many participants said, no, I'll take the 5% and maintain control versus get a little more money and give up control. So we know, so that even tells you even more so how important the control aspect to participants is.
Right.
And then when we ask participants, we're going to go back to the default question a little bit. We ask them how many would prefer to have their account balances ability to generate guaranteed income automatically protected. And the majority said, yeah, I want it automatically protected versus deciding that on my own. It was 53% on that particular question. So the clear preference, once we ask the follow-up question, the clear preference for participants is to default and protect all of their account balance. And then they want the ability to choose how much guaranteed income to take at retirement. And now let me take a pause here and explain how I think about this question. So what they're saying is protect all my account and protect all my money, because I might not know what percent I'm actually going to need to generate guaranteed income when I retire. And so maybe I'm 50 years old today or 55, and I think I'm going to need guaranteed income from half my account, but maybe circumstances change when I retire and I need it from all my account, or maybe only 25% of my account. Mm-hmm. I think of it just like homeowners insurance. I'm going to insure the entire value of my house, because if something happens like a fire, I don't know how much is going to burn down. Maybe only half the house is going to burn down. Do I get upset that I insured all of my house and only half burned down?
Good point.
Right?
Yeah.
Probably not. So same thing, and this is how I think of it. I want all my account protected, even though I don't know how much I'm truly going to quote, turn into guaranteed income, because I don't know what I don't know at this point. Now, plenty of people made the argument, and I don't disagree with them, because you have to pay extra for that protection. So do you really want to pay extra for something if you don't use it? And that's a great argument, by the way. So that on that side, you say, well, no, I'm pretty sure if I know with a high degree of reasonability that I'm only going to need a certain amount of my account protected, then sure, let's only insure that portion.
Right. I would say, though, the other part of that argument is, using your homeowner's insurance analogy, are you disappointed at the end of the year that you paid for that protection and didn't have a fire?
Yeah. Right. Right. How many people get upset that you paid for the insurance and your house didn't burn down? Right.
Darn. Why did I pay that?
Right.
Won't make that mistake again.
That's a good problem, not a bad problem.
Right. That's right.
So a lot of times I'm asked about, well, wait a minute, Glenn, what about the 4% rule? I heard that works. I'm like, yeah, typically speaking, and the 4% rule assumes that you're going to be invested in 50% stocks, 50% bonds, depending who you talk to, maybe 60-40 or 50-50. But net-net, what that means is you can take about the rule of thumb, at least the old rule of thumb, was you can take about 4% of your account balance and your money won't run out. Well, that's true for about 91% of participants, but for about 9%, call it almost 10% of participants, even the 4% rule doesn't work, right? So unless there's a guarantee, you're really relying on luck that you retired in the right year and the stock market didn't crash right before or after you retire and everything's going to work out. Now, if you want to take a little more money, let's say you take 5% instead of 4%. So we'll call it the 5% rule. Then about 30% of participants won't make it. Their money will run out before age 95, for example. So it's a little bit of gamble if you don't have some kind of guaranteed income, if you will. And again, I think we spoke about this earlier, but I'm asked a lot of times, well, how come we haven't done this sooner? Well, we're a young industry. Our industry's only a little bit over 40 years old, and there obviously wasn't a whole lot of need for guaranteed income the first couple of decades, but now there is, right? We're worried about things like longevity risk, living too long. And I jokingly say, I joke with folks that are eating right and exercising right. I said, well, that's a potential catastrophic event.
Right.
The catastrophic event, right, is you're going to live too long. You
Good
could outlive your savings.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
And the other catastrophic event that we have to face is market risk, right? Again, do the markets collapse right before or after I retire? So those are when I think about these guaranteed products and what they're really solving for, they're solving for those two catastrophic events. The markets crash right around when I retire, or I'm in good health and I live too long and I outlive my assets.
Right.
So why now? Why are we talking about retirement income now? Why, what's different about today than 10 years ago or even 5 years ago? Well, number one, the law changed, right? We got it as part of the Secure Act, end of 2019. We have a new safe harbor in place that clarifies the safe harbor for fiduciaries, particularly plan sponsors. They were worried about what happens if, you know, I select one of these products and the insurance company goes out of business 50 years from now. Am I on the hook? Basically, the answer is no, as long as you follow a certain process, right? Would be your defense, if you will. So that safe harbor's out. People really like it. It's kind of what the industry was asking for. So that block, if you will, is out of the way. The other part that was holding this back was technology and portability. So as part of the Safe Harbor Act, there is portability at the participant level built in. So if for some reason you separate employment or the product's not offered anymore, you can do an in-service service withdrawal, roll it to an IRA, and get those benefits grandfathered in by the various insurance companies. So that is taken care of. Technology is getting a lot better now. So we have these middlewares out there that allow you to transfer these products from plan to plan level, if you will. I would say lastly, we know that these products have to be a lot simpler than they were in the past. But these products have been around for a while, but some of them were just too doggone complex for employees to understand what they were. I mean, they have all these weird names too. I mean, it's GLWB and SPIA and DIA and QAC and RIA. I mean, what does all that mean? And that's where it makes, I think it really, and I think that's why, you know, plan sponsors need advisors like yourself, Bruce, that are actually, you know, versed on all these products, because it is the most complicated set of, I think, in my opinion, it's the most complicated set of financial services products in the industry. So really, yeah. and they're very, very different from each other. So how do you know which one, right, is the right kind of product for a plan sponsor and for their employees?
I will say, you know, one thing with the experience I've had, you know, you mentioned, Glenn, how complex some of the products can be, and it's important for the committee to understand, you know, as you said, which is the right one to offer, how does it work, what are the costs, things of that nature. However, for the participants, my experience has been it's very simple. It's, I'm going to get X income when I retire, just like you're talking about your defined benefit plan meeting. It was simple. And that's really how the participants look at it. So sometimes it's the committees that are complicating things. The participant just wants to know what my income is going to be.
That's a great point. Yeah, I didn't think of it that way. As a matter of fact, when I try to explain all the various products to, whether I'm talking to plan sponsors or advisors or the media, I liken it to it's just like buying a car, meaning that, you know, when you go to buy a car, let's say you're trying to buy a car for you got a 16-year-old and you're going to help them buy their first car and help them choose it. How do you go about choosing that car? Do you explain all the nuts and bolts to the 16-year-old? Say, oh, you know, do you want an 8-cylinder or a 6-cylinder, or do you want a turbo, or do you want a 4-cylinder? Do you want a, you know, they probably don't even know what. Some of them aren't going to know what that even means. You probably take a step back and say, well, you know, let's try and figure out what type of car is a good fit for you. Meaning, do you want something that's like an SUV that, you know, gives you a lot of flexibility and, you know, multi-purpose? Or are you looking for a sports car? Although I wouldn't recommend putting a 16-year-old in a sports car. But those are the types of conversations you'd have, right, with a new car buyer. That, let's figure out what type of car you want. And then once you figure out what type of car, then you start comparing the various features of that car, meaning that let's just say we're going to buy our 16-year-old a SUV or help them get that SUV. Well, do you want four-wheel drive with that? Do you want a sunroof with that? Do you want leather seats, automatic brakes, you know, all that fun stuff. Now, you might be thinking, well, why is Glenn talking about cars so much? Well, again, buying these guaranteed products is very similar, meaning that there's a lot of different types. So there's, you know, there's an SUV type that does, you know, lets you have all this flexibility. There's others that will pay a higher rate, but you have less flexibility, right? Just like a car. And of course, they charge. So the more features and benefits that you buy or want in your product, the more they're going to charge you for it. So just like a car, think of it just like a car. The more stuff, more options you load up on a car, the more expensive that car is going to be. So the trick is, when you're looking at these guaranteed income products, is don't buy features or benefits that you don't want, right? If it offers a whole bunch of stuff that I always give the example about the sunroof. I hate sunroofs, right, in my cars. But believe it or not, the last two cars I bought already had a sunroof, and I ended up paying $1,000 more for something I did not want. And we really should not do that, right? With participants are paying the freight here in terms of expense ratio. So that's something I just, and by the way, the SECURE Act basically tells us to do it that way. So what does, so when I think about, I'm going to move into the SECURE Act a little bit and say, let's look at what it tells us to do. So we still have to do the normal, engage in an objective, thorough, and analytical process like we do with any investment. So you're not really, you still have to go through, have that process. It needs to be thorough and analytical. But what the SECURE Act, goes on and goes in a little more detail about was to specifically consider the cost of the guaranteed retirement contract in relation to the product features, benefits, and administrative services under the contract. So, and it says that the relative cost needs to be reasonable. And then they put in capital letters, and I've never seen this before, capital letters in the actual law itself, no requirement to choose the lowest cost product, which I thought was very interesting. Yeah. I can only surmise that's because we've seen all these lawsuits around fees and 401k plans, and they want to, put fiduciaries' mind at ease. Like, no, it's okay to pay for these products and pay for the appropriate features and benefits that's going to be a benefit to your employees. And then lastly, we need to get a written representation from the insurer that meets certain financial barriers or hurdles, if you will. And we need to get that on an annual basis. And that's actually fairly easy to get. So it's really, have a process, follow the process. The SECURE Act gives us, a nice outline for what we need to do. At the end of the day, it's looking at what are the features and benefits of that particular guaranteed retirement income product, and how much does it cost? And is it reasonable? And then compare it to other products, right? And try and find the best value. So what makes it hard, though, is there's no central database that exists. So in the mutual fund world, it's always difficult, but it's fairly easy. There's a database. We can compare. We can manipulate the numbers, and they're all in a database. We can pull from them and do all kinds of great comparisons. In the guaranteed in-plan contract world, we don't have that. So what we have to do, and we developed a tool along with Brad Campbell to help do this, is develop a, call it more of a template to help do this comparison, if you will. And what we do is we identify the top 10 features and benefits, both at the plan level and the participant level, and allow fiduciaries to change those if they don't like what we're doing. Put those out there and allow advisors and consultants like yourself, Bruce, to have that conversation and document it with plan sponsors on how important is each particular feature and benefit. For example, is it very important, high importance, medium importance, low importance? Because again, you don't want to pay for features and benefits that are not important to the plan sponsor and their employees. And then once you do that, we simply recommend that you judge how well each product performs at that particular feature and benefit. So there's some subjectivity here. So you have to kind of look at it and say, well, how well do they actually do what they say they're going to do? Especially relative to other products, are they a 3-star? In our tool, we think we put it as 3-star being the best and 1-star being the worst, for example. And just kind of go through the contracts, go through all the features and benefits, and tally them up, right? And they get it. We have a scoring system based on what they offer, how well they do it, and how important is it to each plan sponsor. So to develop a custom feature and benefit score, then add up all the fees, and plot them on a scatter diagram so that at the end of the day, you know, you can look at them all on one sheet of paper and say, you know what? If I'm looking at three products, I want the product that has the highest score at the lowest cost. And that's what I'm going to go with. And I've got it documented on why it went that way. And, you know, so that goes a long, long way in terms of meeting one's fiduciary responsibility and qualifying for that safe harbor.
Mm-hmm.
So then again, the last part is just getting that written representation from the insurance company on an annual basis. So in this part, by the way, we've worked with Brad Campbell, who was a former assistant secretary of the Employee Benefits Group of the Department of Labor, to develop this template slash tool, if you will, and write the legal white paper that kind of supports what we did.
Very good. Yeah, I've used the tool and it's fantastic.
Good to hear. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'm asked by either plan sponsors or advisors, hey, well, where do I start? What if I don't even know if my employees want these guaranteed income? Or how do I start? Well, I'm taking a page out of the 90s. What I would suggest is just go and, you know, survey your employees, maybe whether it's a survey or, you know, questionnaire or whatever you want to call it. But you can literally make it a 3 or 4 question survey. You know, question one, do you want, you know, guaranteed income or something similar, you know, to a traditional pension plan, yes or no? If so, we're going to ask a few questions to help us figure out, well, what type of product is going to be a good fit. So my next question I would ask is, well, what percent of your 401k balance do you want protected, or do you want to generate income? Do you want all of it? You want 75%, 25%, something different? You know, get a feel for how much they want protected. Get a feel for how much income they think is attractive. You know, you can literally say, hey, it's 5%. If your cap balance could generate 5% income, is that something that's attractive? And then lastly, I'd ask them how important it is to maintain control of their investments. And again, our surveys show that's very important. But you want to reinforce that or make sure you know that for your employee group, right? And I think by asking a few questions, they'll find out, is there interest? And if there is interest, it'll give you a general direction of what types of products to look at. And the reason I say that is that there's so many different types of products out there. There are some that are, you know, play very good income rates, but you lose control, or some, you know, have explicit fees, some have implicit fees. So how do you compare those when maybe not all fees are disclosed? So there's a lot of moving parts, and it does make your job a lot harder, Bruce.
Yes. Thank you, Glenn. But the tool is really gives a lot of great insights, and really, you know, based on questions like this, can really help guide the plan sponsor, I should say, in, as you said, in the right direction and compare one product to another. So it really is a great tool in that regard.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. So those great insights, Glenn. I really appreciate you sharing that research and your experience and expertise with us. To our listeners, I would say if you'd like to receive, you know, a copy of the participant survey or learn how to utilize the income blueprint tool that Glenn was referring to, you can reach out to me. Again, my name is Bruce Lanzer. My number is 414-289-3817. Again, that's 414-289-3817. Or email me at Bruce, B-R-U-C-E, dot Lanzer, L-A-N-S as in Sam, E-R, at UBS.com. Again, thank you for your time, Glenn, and thanks for listening.
Thank you, Bruce. My pleasure.
Great. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate agreements. It is important that clients understand the ways in which we conduct business and that they carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide to them about the products or services we offer. For more information, visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. UBS Financial Services Incorporated is a subsidiary of UBS AG, and a member of FINRA and SIPC.